Hello, and welcome to the AXA-XL Healthcare Risk Insights Podcast. I'm your host, Shalay Hendrickson, Head of Healthcare Bermuda. On today's episode, we are going to discuss crisis standard of care. I'm excited to share this podcast with John West. John is currently employed as the principal of West Consulting Services, an independent risk management and patient safety consulting firm that specializes in continuing medical legal education for hospitals, physicians, and nurses. John has been the author of the Case Law Update column, which appears quarterly in the Journal of Healthcare Risk Management. He is a regular speaker at national and regional risk management meetings and has published numerous articles on risk management. Welcome to the podcast, John.
Thank you.
John, to get us started, what is the standard of care and what role does it play in medical malpractice litigation?
Well, the standard of care is really fundamental. If you recall the four elements of a negligence action, they're duty, breach of duty, injury as a result of the breach of duty, and damages. The duty is to act within the standard of care. The standard of care really sets the parameters for the duty. And the duty is a legal determination for the court to decide. It's not a jury issue. There's no factual dispute over whether or not there was a duty. It's for the court to determine whether there was a duty. And it's important that it arises out of the provider-patient relationship. And that'll get to be more important as we talk a little further. Failing to conform to the standard of care is a breach of the duty, and this is really fundamental. It's kind of the cornerstone of a medical malpractice action.
Where does the standard of care come from?
Well, the standard of care is an interesting legal construct. It's an objective standard that arises primarily from the literature of medicine. It can come out of a medical treatise. It can come out of an article. It can come out of accepted practice among physicians in patient care. And it's an accepted practice by competent physicians. If you fail to meet the standard, it means that the physician was not acting as a competent physician would have acted under the same or similar circumstances. It's not what any particular physician would do in any particular situation. That's a subjective standard. This is an objective standard, and there has to be something that the expert can point to show that this is what the standard of care is in this particular situation. However, in the final analysis, the standard of care is what the more credible of two qualified experts says it is. And to unpack that a little bit, there are going to be at least two experts in a medical malpractice action, one for the plaintiff and one for the defendant. They have to be qualified by the court as experts to provide expert testimony. When they provide their testimony, then it boils down to which one of the two experts was more credible in the eyes of the jury. And that's pretty much, it's kind of a pessimistic way to look at it, but it really is who the jury believes and what the jury believes the standard of care is.
Thanks for that, John. Can you now explain the crisis standard of care and its origin?
Sure. The crisis standard of care, it has been promulgated by certain authoritative sources. The Institute of Medicine had a publication about the crisis standard of care in 2012. Various state departments have weighed in on what is the crisis standard of care, and the AMA has guidance on what is the crisis standard of care. Basically, if you think about it in terms of capacity, there's the normal capacity of a healthcare system, and that is where everything is running at about normal levels. Then you have a surge or a contingency capacity, and that is, let's say, for example, you have 20 ICU beds, and you normally run at 10 occupied beds at any point in time. A surge or a contingency might be where you go up to 16, 18, possibly even 20 occupied beds. The crisis standard of care comes in when you have a need for more than 20 ICU beds. And that indicates that you're over capacity and you have to start getting really, really creative about how to provide services for your patient population. Now, I have to say that at present, it's only a thing if courts decide it's a thing and allow experts to testify regarding it. I think they will, but you never really know what courts are going to do with something. And I don't know how the courts dealt with this crisis standard of care in 1918 with the Spanish flu, but however they did it, it was well before medical malpractice was a recognized cause of action. The other thing is that you have to remember that the crisis standard of care involves care for the population. It's doing the greatest good for the greatest number. And it recognizes that in a time of crisis, it may not be possible to do everything for everybody. However, we've seen this in the past, but not to the degree we see now. The capacity that I talked about earlier was a matter of degree rather than of kind. And in the past, we have certainly seen where the ED is swamped or the ED is slammed, and the standard of care has remained patient-centered, i.e., there hasn't been talk of doing the right thing for the right number of patients. It's been, what have you done for this patient? And when you get to litigation, the jury is really not going to be particularly receptive to arguments that the ED was so busy and that's why this guy's myocardial infarction wasn't diagnosed in time. They don't really care what else has been going on in the ED. They want to know what you did for your patient. And that's important in the legal standard of care that we're going to talk about.
John, what would you say is the difference between the crisis standard of care and the traditional standard of care?
The usual standard of care is patient-centric. It's the standard applied to the care of a particular patient. It arises out of the provider-patient relationship, and it's specific to that patient. The crisis standard of care is population-centric. It's doing the greatest good for the greatest number at the time that care is provided. So the crisis standard of care may be good for the population, and the people who will get the most benefit from the care will receive it, but the people who might benefit from the care will probably not receive it. And we have to have a crisis standard of care simply because of the scarcity of resources, such as personnel, ventilators, etc. If you've got 20 ICU beds and you've got 30 patients who need an ICU bed, you have to do something to accommodate them. This usually involves triage of some sort to determine who would benefit from the treatment and where the treatment might be futile. And it also means to withdraw treatment if it becomes unlikely to achieve its goal. The challenge here is to refrain from making value judgments about the quality of a patient's life, i.e. the disabled, the elderly, the people with multiple comorbid conditions, or the patient's social worth, and rely solely on the medicine and the available resources.
John, since you just mentioned the elderly, how would you say the crisis standard of care is different in a long-term setting versus a hospital setting?
There typically is not the scarcity of resources in long-term care. I mean, they don't have ICUs. Well, they may have ventilators. But what they would have to do is to make sure that the people who are going to benefit the most, i.e. those who have a chance of recovery versus those for whom the care will be futile, and basically allocate the resources accordingly. Like I said, if you've got 110 patients in a long-term care facility and they all have, or they're all infected with COVID-19, you can't necessarily give perfect care to all of them, and you may have to allocate care to the ones who are going to benefit from it the most.
As a result of COVID-19, many states have issued immunities for healthcare providers. Some of the immunities do not apply to willful misconduct, gross negligence, and other acts. Can you define what willful misconduct and gross negligence acts consist of?
Well, as a general rule, the best way to describe it is to look at the outcome of a claim for reckless endangerment, willful and wanton conduct, etc. Normally, the damages available in medical malpractice cases, they can be for lost wages, they can be for medical expenses, they can be for pain and suffering. In cases involving willful and wanton misconduct, you have a species of damage called punitive damages. And punitive damages are meant to punish and deter the wrongdoer from doing again what they did in this patient's care. Generally speaking, these things are an enhanced form of negligence, and the degree of culpability of the caregiver is what you look for in gross negligence. Nobody really blames a caregiver for making a mistake, but if the caregiver does something intentionally or with reckless disregard for the safety of the patient, then they can be liable for punitive damages, and they may have committed reckless endangerment, willful and wanton misconduct, etc.
How can healthcare providers avoid liability for willful misconduct or gross negligence claims?
Well, generally speaking, as long as they conform to the standard of care in their specialty, and that is, under any particular given circumstances, the provider is expected to act in a particular way. Gross negligence often involves willful indifference. It can be where, for example, I was involved in a case not too long ago where a patient came into the hospital with constipation, which was probably opioid-induced. Well, they thought that the patient, with administration of enemas and laxatives, would resolve the constipation. And as it turned out, the patient ended up with a perforation of her gut, became septic, and died. I would say that this was a case where the hospital, the surgeon, the hospitalists were close to being willfully indifferent to the safety of the patient, because there comes a time when you have to say to yourself, what I'm seeing is not what I think I'm seeing, and change for the better. If you abandon a patient, if you give a patient a treatment that is not approved by the FDA or is not in the mainstream, you may be acting in a way that is indifferent to the patient's safety.
John, what are the legal issues surrounding the crisis standard of care?
There's usually a battle of the experts. The problem will come in that the plaintiff will have an expert who argues for a patient-centered standard of care, and that is, this is what you did for my patient, and this is how it didn't meet the standard of care. The defendant will argue for a population-centered standard of care. And in that situation, they will be saying that under the circumstances, there were patients who would benefit more from the care than the patient who is the subject of this litigation. The problem is that it's going to be very, very difficult for the jury to understand what's going on, and the court will have to clarify it. How the court clarifies it is really not known at the present time. Like I said, there has not been a case yet, at least not that has risen to the appellate level, regarding the crisis standard of care and its applicability to a particular case.
You have just explained the legal issues. Now, can you touch on the ethical issues associated with the crisis standard of care?
Well, there are a number of ethical issues associated with this standard of care. One of them is all patients have autonomy. They have the right to determine what care they're going to receive and what care they're going to refuse. In this case, someone is refusing care on their behalf, and this is potentially an infringement on their autonomy. Another ethical premise is beneficence. Beneficence comes in from the old phrase, primum non nocere, and the physician should do no harm. It's not possible to be beneficent to all patients in a scarce resource situation. Consequently, beneficence is something that has to be done for particular patients, and there are some patients for whom this principle will not apply because care for them would be futile and they wouldn't really benefit from it in the long term. The principle of justice requires that healthcare resources be allocated equitably. And in this case, generally speaking, we can allocate resources equitably as long as we have criteria for allocation and the criteria are followed scrupulously. There are certain things that can be outside the equitable allocation. For example, someone for whom the care would be futile is not going to be allocated resources. The other thing is that occasionally you have healthcare providers who are in need of scarce resources, ventilators, ICU beds, etc. And it is acceptable under the AMA standards for them to be given preferential treatment. After all, if the healthcare providers can't provide healthcare, then our whole system starts to collapse. The ethical issues are really balancing one patient's rights against another's or against the rights of the population. And under the crisis standard of care, it really comes down to doing the greatest good for the greatest number who will benefit from the care.
How does the crisis standard of care affect individual providers as well as hospitals?
Well, there is a disconnect between the patient-centric standard of care and the population-centric standard of care. In this situation, you have to have objective bases for all healthcare decisions regarding care, because you know that there's a balancing here, if not a conflict, between the two standards of care. And if you have criteria and you evaluate them objectively, you will probably be okay. You need to be mindful of the availability of resources when making allocation decisions. And by no means should you make refusal of care decisions lightly. In my estimation, they should be a last resort. You should only make allocation decisions when your back is up against the wall and you can't accommodate all patients. And then I would also say that even if critical interventions are not possible, that doesn't mean the patient shouldn't get care. The AMA provides that patients who are refused critical interventions should still be given palliative care if life-sustaining treatments are withheld.
John, once we get through the COVID-19 pandemic, do you anticipate any litigation in regards to standard of care not being met?
Unless a state provides immunity specifically for decisions made under the standard of care, and there are states who are providing such immunities, with the immunity, you may be okay as long as you had an objective basis for all of your decisions that were made and that you stuck to your criteria and made the decisions objectively. In the event that states don't allow immunity for healthcare providers and facilities, I think there's a possibility that we may see a wave of litigation involving patients who didn't get the care that they needed because of their long-term prognosis or the futility of providing care for them.
John, it was a pleasure to have you join the podcast today. You have provided us with crisis standard of care insights that I trust will be useful to our listeners. Thank you for listening to the XXL Healthcare Risk Insights podcast. Stay tuned for future podcasts where we will dive into other current and developing risks impacting the healthcare industry.